There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the House of Cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Welcome once again to Strange Planet. Great to have you with me. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the legend of the lost continent of Atlantis, this supposedly mythical island nation, the inhabitants of which supposedly possessed incredible advanced technology. It's mentioned in Plato's dialogues and has been dismissed by many skeptics as merely an allegory on the hubris of nations. But what if Atlantis was real? What if there were a place on Earth that matched Plato's description of Atlantis to a scientifically proven 99.32% accuracy? David Edward knows where Atlantis is and has proven it in his book, Atlantis Solved, the final definitive proof. He's published over 40 books, about evenly split between historical fiction and nonfiction, including the best-selling thriller Panama Red, the first book in a series that has sold over 100,000 copies. Previously, David wrote Coral Castle, A Short History Of, Maya, A Short History Of, and DMT, A Short History Of. He served as a special agent in the U.S. Army in the 1980s and 90s and is a veteran of multiple overseas combat tours. He was the special agent in charge of the 1990 Panama Canal counterterrorism threat assessment report to the U.S. Congress. He's a graduate of the United States Army Intelligence School, where he studied advanced human intelligence and battlefield counterintelligence, also completing training at the Jungle Operations Training Center in Panama, Central America. He holds four graduate degrees, including a doctorate in engineering, and he hosts a weekly podcast on the writing industry that often serves as many as 30,000 views per episode, and he's got a new project he'll tell us about. Where does he find the time? Well, let's find out. David, Edward, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing good, sir. As you're reading that, I'm just listening. I'm thinking, wow, I'm an old guy. Basically, you could have shortened it, right?
Wow. I mean, I could spend the whole episode just your bona fides are just incredible.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I hate to do it. I never know whether people want to know that stuff or not. But when you're talking about Atlantis, I've found it helps to at least have people understand where you're coming from. And I have a pretty good background to be looking for it. So I appreciate you reading that whole thing. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Before we get started, tell us about the history of project that you're working about right now.
Yeah, well, thank you. So, yeah, the Atlanta book has done pretty good. It was number one. I was on Coast to Coast AM in August, and it was number one for like a month, which blew me away. I mean, you know, the reception of it has been very good. So what I'm doing is I have a new YouTube channel called A History Of, and basically we're very methodically going through all of the details because people, they like to read the books, but lots of people like to really dig into the details because they've heard so many things on Atlantis. They want to understand not just what someone says it is, but why they're saying that and what the supporting evidence to back that up is. So that's what we're doing on the A History Of channel. And it's only been out for a month and it's doing pretty good. I've got one video that's got, I think, 20 or 30,000 views, and I just hit 1200 subscribers today. So, you know, it's a good start. It's very hard to grow these channels. So if anyone's interested, please do subscribe. Yeah.
You know, so much of what I talk about on this podcast and it gets discussed on Coast to Coast seem like these inscrutable riddles and almost like a swamp that, you know, you get absorbed by it, but there's never any resolution, whether we're talking about Bigfoot or UFOs. I think many people would have put Atlantis in that same category. And yet, here it is, perhaps, probably, resolution complete, like case closed, right? Are you that confident about it?
I am. I was very naive when I wrote that title, I'll be honest, because I wasn't as in the industry as I am now. So Atlantis is a funny thing. I love the space. It's a fantastic topic, and it's fun. And people are as passionate about the locations they think Atlantis are as they are about current politics, maybe more so. But Atlantis is a safe topic, right? We used to argue politics a lot, right? They used to be a fun. I used to love to argue politics. I had many friends that believed different things. But today is hard to do that. But now I can go in and we can argue Atlantis. Yeah. What I didn't realize with Atlantis, was many people have almost religious-like beliefs about it. So I came in with this analytical approach, and you know, 75% of the people that hear it or I talked about it love it. But there's a group that doesn't see Atlantis that way, and they get frustrated by it. So it's just fascinating to be in that space and get to talk to all those different people.
Right. Yeah. You thought you were wading into hey, Atlantis, nobody gets hurt. Let's talk about it.
Nobody. Well, and you read my bio. I was president of a university for a while. I was the chief editor of an academic paper. So I have a foot on the academic side. I'm not employed in academics anymore. I've been the dean of a school. I've taught for years. And I'm also a kook. I'm a nerd. I grew up on this stuff. So, and I've got the military background that you went over. I mean, I'm really well-rounded to look for this. And what I've learned, the book's been out about 8 months, 7 months, like that. What I've learned to do is to be able to talk about it with folks without feeling like they're attacking me. Because what they're really doing is they're projecting their beliefs about, and they've associated it with themselves. So I've learned how to talk about it because, you know, we all today, if someone says something we don't like, we think we have the absolute right to get mad and throw our hands up and start screaming, you know. But so I've learned how not to do that, which has been a huge personal growth for me. It's hard. Everything's hard, but that's exceptionally hard. But I'm so proud of myself for having learned to do that. So for me, that's one thing that this space has brought.
So let's, I know you, whenever the subject comes up, you talk about Jim Corsetti, a fellow Army vet. Because it was his work, I guess, in 2018, sort of really focusing attention on the location that we now believe Atlantis is situated in. Just to tell us a little bit, for those not familiar with Corsetti's work, what he was on about.
Yeah, and there's two guys. There's Jimmy Corsetti, who has a channel called Bright Insight. And I mentioned jokingly that I'm an old guy. Old guys, as you may know, I don't know, you might get to this, we sometimes have a hard time sleeping. So I was having one of those nights, and I got up and I got on YouTube, and YouTube handed me his video. And I'm coming to this party very late because in 2018, this whole thing blew up. He's been on Joe Rogan, and he kind of, I believe he found it. Where he is struggling, in my opinion, is proving it, because he doesn't have the weight of an academic education behind him. I mean, he's got an MBA in marketing. He's not uneducated, but it's not in the Atlantis space. So there's him, and there's another guy, David Stig Hansen, who has a channel of his own name on YouTube. And David actually has become very friendly with me, and he went to the Reshat structure in January of 2022, and he was there the entire month of October. And he has all we probably agree 90%, but there was a number of samples I wanted collected, pictures I wanted, things I wanted looked at, and he was kind enough to do it. So he's kind of my on ground piece. Yeah, both those guys are on YouTube. Jimmy Corsetti is very popular. His videos have had millions and millions of views. And I'm basically adding on to his work, but I always mention it. I even called him, I've talked to him. I don't want people to think I'm trying to hijack this. I've had a few people say, well, you're ripping the guy. I'm not ripping him off. I'm trying to help him. I think he's right, and he can't go it alone. So that's why I'm jumping in.
Right. And so you took Corsetti, his work, and you applied some methodology that was lacking.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And so I mentioned I was the publisher of an academic journal, I think the 2008, 2009 edition. So a little while ago, but I know that process. I know the peer review process. I've written my own articles. By the time you get all these silly degrees, you've been through this thesis and dissertation process enough times. I know the process. I know how to do that. I know how to frame it. And I also have kind of a ruthless analytical mind. So I can really look past a lot of noise, which you have to do in the Atlantis space. One of the things you typically do if you're going to do academic research in any field is you formulate your question, and then you see what the current opinion of the field is. So you do you research what's known about it. What are the current views and all of that? And I started to do that with Atlantis, but it's next to impossible because everyone has said everything. Atlantis has been beaten to death, and we've all heard absolutely everything about it. So what I had to end up doing was I did all the work again. So I went back, I treated Plato as a primary source. I talked to the dean of philosophy at Yale University to make sure to get her opinion on that. And their opinion is, academically, you could, there's clearly historical pieces in there, but they view him much more as philosophy. But that aside, what I do is I say, and I'm coming at this, I'm an engineer, and I'm what I call a physical historian. So I'm interested in the fact that Poseidon dated a mountain girl. I mean, all that, that's great. That's interesting. But I can't measure that. I can't go look. I can't find that. So what I did is I decomposed the dialogues, Critias and Timaeus, and I break them down into, and I do all the work in the book. I mean, you can see it. I show you the dialogues and I start decomposing them. And what I end up with is a list of requirements. And then I organize them in a meaningful way. And now I basically say, Atlantis turns out, after you read it, it's three things. It was a city, it was a continent, and it was a kingdom. So I broke the requirements down into each of those three buckets. And then I looked everywhere. I looked at like 15 different places. I actually did a survey on Reddit. I said, where does everyone think Atlantis is? And everywhere they said they thought it was, I looked and I did all the analysis. And the one I landed on as the capital was the Reshat structure, which is this thing in West Africa. But I struggle in these conversations because, Richard, everyone you talk to, they say, where is Atlantis? Like it's one thing. But when you really dig into the dialogues, Plato tells us it was in 10 places. And he gives us the names of the kings of all of the, or the princes of all those places. For example, the king of Atlantis, who was at the capital, was named Atlas. So there we look for things that involve the word Atlas. But there's 9 other names. So what I did is I started looking for them. So for example, the eldest of the fifth set of twins is named Azores.
Well,
that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes. There's a lot of people that think the Azores are Atlantis. And then, and I always have to say, well, wait, it is Atlantis. And the plural of Atlantis is Atlantis. So the vocabulary is not going to help us. But it wasn't the cap. It can't be the capital. The work you got to do to make the Azores the capital starts to go into fiction. I mean, the idea that there's the Earth crust, not Earth crust display, what they call a glacial rebound created. It doesn't work. You can't meet the land masses in the dialogue. But when you start to look at where it is positioned from a seafaring and trade standpoint, it was probably the richest of all the provinces, because if you look at trade routes, which is one thing I analyze, is 15th, 16th, and 17th century trade routes under the theory of, as people were figuring out how to do it then, maybe that's going to clue us into how they would have done it before. And all the trade routes basically work. If you're heading west, you tend to go down the coast of Africa and then across, because that's how the currents take you, and then you end up at the top, like in Colombia-ish. Mm-hmm. When you're heading east, when you're heading back, they take you north, and they actually take you through the Azores. So I'm doing all this analysis on the channel, but the Azores, I think everything that people have found is right. It's just, but it just wasn't the capital, because none of the geography, we can't find any of it.
I'm going to assume there were no princes named Bimini, as in Bimini Road. So that one's off the dock, it is.
Well, it's not off the dock. I'm going to be vague on that. I don't touch on that in the book, and I'm going through these in the videos, but Bimini and what they call Aztlan, A-Z-T-L-A-N, are both things that we're going to explore on that channel. Now, one of the criteria we have, because we're told in the dialogues that the Atlanteans conquered the parts of the Mediterranean from Libya up to Egypt and parts of Europe and the terrain and Terrania, which is basically Italy, and that there's a Terranian Sea in there. Well, to conquer something sociopolitically, we're still dealing with people, so there has to be some reason to do it.
Proximity.
And you have to be close enough to do it. And the technology, one of my assumptions is that the things we know about our past have to hold generally. We can't just blow the whole thing up. Now, anytime I deviate from that, what I do is I create a percentage. And I say, like, for example, we looked at Crete, and Crete lines up. It's not outside the Pillars of Heracles or where we think they were. So it's too close. But could it have been one of these provinces? Maybe there's some linguistics that line up perfectly, but academically we can get all the way back to 7,000 BCE. It's clean academic science that Crete has been occupied for 130,000 years, but in 7,000 BCE, there was an agrarian transformation, which is what we look for when we look for Atlanteans, because Plato tells us that they were very good at agriculture and they were very good at organizing themselves. They weren't very good at war because they lost.
Right? Well,
they lost it. Well, whatever the Greeks were, exactly. Whatever the proto-Greeks, you get in trouble if you use the wrong word.
Right.
So whoever was in Greece, 9,600 BCE, proto-Greeks, whatever, were able to beat them back, whatever that means.
So no nuclear subs, no free energy crystal devices. No,
I'm not saying no. I'm not even saying I don't know. I don't care if that's a callous way of saying it. But I'm an engineer, so stuff I can see, and a physical historian, stuff I can see. So I've got Plato's dialogue, which I've decided to treat as historically accurate. That's an assumption, but it's okay. We've identified that it is an assumption. And then we have to assume this fits into generally what we know about ourselves. So I always say I'm like the Grinch who's stealing Christmas, because, you got the big Christmas present. You open it, you've been dreaming about it for weeks. You open it, it's tube socks and underwear, but which you need. There's nothing wrong with it. But that's what I think Atlantis was. I think it was advanced agriculturally. Matter of fact, I think it was incredibly advanced agriculturally. And I found all kinds of evidence that we're in the process of laying out around this Rishat structure that no one even talks about because no one's looked for it. And I know, based on the work that David Stig Hansen has done, we know where to dig too. We know where to dig in West Africa. No one's dug there yet. But it's not at the Rishat structure, because there's some topology that you can look at.
Okay, so let's get back to Plato, where Atlantis is mentioned in the two dialogues, Critias and Timaeus. Who was Critias?
That's it. Now, that's just, have you heard me talk about this? Is that a setup question?
Is it a setup question?
Have you heard me talk about this?
No.
Well, then that's the greatest question I've ever been asked. I am the Critias expert when it comes to Critias. So basically, there's three Critias. So we have Solon, who the dialogues say went to Egypt and took notes. And Solon says he wrote the stuff down at the Temple of Neith at Sais. That whole place we can get into. I don't want to go off of your question, but there's a whole history there I can talk to and lay out. Critias is a huge problem because we have these two dialogues. One's called Critias, one called, I call it Timaeus. I believe, did you say, I believe the correct pronunciation is Timaeus, but I struggle. I get tongue-tied, so I say Timaeus because they're both like hard eyes. But anyway, the Critias one, and everyone has always assumed and forced the distinction that they're the same person in both dialogues. But Plato often brings back a slightly different cadre of speakers in a subsequent dialogue to allow the conversation to go in different places. I've done all the research. I've laid this out. But to get to your answer, in the Critias dialogue, we're dealing with Critias, the grandfather. He's the middle Critias. So we had Solon, who had a brother named Dropides, who had a son named Critias, who became Critias the elder, who isn't part of this story. Then he had a son. And then that son named his son Critias, who became Critias the grandfather, because he had a son who had a son who they named Critias, who became Critias the tyrant. He was one of the 30 tyrants in Athens, like 402 BC. In the Critias dialogue, it's Critias the grandfather who's talking, and he even says very specifically that he still possesses the writings of Solon from when he went to Egypt, and he has studied them, and that's what he's recounting.
So Solon was not a contemporary of Plato. Solon went to Egypt, where he learned about their history, including what they knew about Atlantis, and he took that back to Greece.
Solon is around 600 BCE. Arguably, he's the father of democracy. He's the guy that was sitting around in his robe or whatever they did in 600 BCE and said, you know, there might be a better way to do this. So he kind of went on a tour of the known world, and he was gathering information. He was trying to come up with how do you have a democracy, because it had never been done before. So he's a very important and well-known historical figure. All those names I mentioned are well-known historical figures. I don't remember the question you asked me.
Well, it was about who. No, you answered it. Who was? Okay. Well, I asked whether Solon was a contemporary of Plato, but he came before, obviously. So Critias is a descendant of Solon. He has Solon's, all the paperwork.
He's the paperwork. Critias, the grandfather, has the paperwork. And then, and I lay this out, and then in 420 BC, Critias, the grandfather, tells the story to the Critias that would become Critias the tyrant. And this is important because this is mentioned in the Timaeus dialogue. Critias, the grandfather, was 90 in 420 BCE, and Critias the tyrant was 10. Which is exactly what the dialogue says. So we know exactly when the Timaeus dialogue date was, 420 BCE, which lines up perfectly. Plato, that's when Socrates was, you know, talking about horse flies and irritating everyone and really into it. So we can line these dates up. And I do want to go back. So, and we can go farther. This temple of Neith at Sais that Solon went to, it's an incredibly important temple. Matter of fact, I can't believe it's so important. It was, first off, when he went there, Sais was the capital of Egypt. It's in the Western Delta. The temple of Neith was founded before 3000 BCE, which is so it's pre-dynastic. It's before the first Egyptian dynasty. Now, the Egyptian dynasties that we use, it's just a contrivance. It's just basically around 2900 BCE, they started writing stuff down. And so we say, okay, well, when writing shows up, which is a technology as an engineer, that's when we're going to start saying they're dynasties. So there was a lot going on before that, but to us, that's how we've contrived it. But Neith, she is the prime creator goddess. She is in the Egyptian pantheon. She's the mother of all of the gods. She's the mother of Ra. She's the mother of the entire pantheon. And the Neith cult actually forms in 6000 BCE on the West Nile Delta. We can trace it all the way back to that. And it's really hard to see that far back. We also have like on Malta and Sicily and those areas, we have this weird mother goddess cult, and we don't know what it is. We have these figurines of this very heavy woman figure, and they don't know what it is. But if you look at a map, Malta's not that far from Egypt, and we know we're talking west of Egypt, and we know we have this Neith cult. So I'm not saying it's related. I don't have any evidence of that. I'm just saying when you start to look at it, currently academics have a philosophy that societies evolve in isolation around this time in ancient history. That they, when they look at something, that's how they look at it. They assume that the Aztecs were isolated from the Egyptians, who were isolated from whatever was going on in Spain or South Africa, you know, whatever. And when, if you turn that around, you say, let's assume there was associations, which is just an assumption, the whole picture changes. And that's really what I wish I could figure out a way to get us to do, because so much of the information is already put together. It's just fragmented and off to the side, and we pretend like it doesn't exist.
We're going to take a time out, David. When we come back, we'll talk about what Plato actually wrote about Atlantis. We'll get into all of the particulars. David Edward is with us, and the author of Atlantis Solved, The Final Definitive Proof. Stay with us.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The truth will set you free, free, free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
All right, David Edward is with us. He knows where Atlantis is. He's proven it in his book, Atlantis Solved, The Final Definitive Proof. So, Plato, in these two dialogues, Critias and Timaeus.
And I'm going to screw you up on how you pronounce them, sorry.
That's okay. So, just kind of run through the laundry list. It's an important laundry list, but of what Plato had to say or had to write about Atlantis.
Yeah, and there's a lot. You know, I don't want to just do a brain dump, but there's two lines that. So I've created in these videos on my channel what I call the Atlantis Detector, and it's a silly name. It's supposed to be a silly name, but there's basically there's a. And remember, we have the city, we have the continent, we have the kingdom. But the capital city has to sit on a landmass that's going to meet the requirement for the continent. And there's a line, I'll read it here, that is in there that I never have heard. I've watched every show that's ever been made, as far as I know, since 1972 about Atlantis. I've never heard this, but here's the line. It says, "The country immediately about and surrounding the city was a level plain, itself surrounded by mountains which descended towards the sea. It was smooth and even and of an oblong shape extending in the one direction, 3,000 stadia." And I looked at that. I came across that and I just struggled. And I stared at it forever because I couldn't. It's hard to know what it means. But then I started looking. I'm like, well, every time I watch a documentary, they always go to Crete and then they go to Santorini. And then maybe they go to Malta or they end up in Spain or they just go in the Greek islands, you know, that kind of thing. But what I think this says is that there's a 3,000 stadia gentle sloping plain to the sea from the city. So we have a lot to unpack. So what's a stadia? That'd be a good thing to start with, right? So it turns out a stadia is, and there's, you can pick, depending on how you want to ground the dialogues, there's a couple different measurements you can pick. The one that I think makes the most sense is the unit of measure that was used during Plato's lifetime, because we're told that the names and measurements are translated into Greek. So another thing that people don't really realize is that Plato and Alexander the Great were alive at the same time for like 12 years. I mean, Alexander was a kid and Plato was an old guy. But what became what they call the Alexandrian measure of a stadia is what the measurement was during Plato's time. It's basically 606.9 feet. So I just say 607 feet because none of this is that exact. So when you multiply 607 feet by 3,000, you get like 1.8 million something, and you divide it by 5,280, which is a mile, and you get 345 miles. So almost by accident, I had done that, and then I went to Google Earth, and I measured how far inland the Rishat structure was from the Atlantic Ocean. It was 345 miles. I stared at the screen for like an hour. Cause you know, you're just like, what? So I'm like, okay, I kind of didn't think it was going to be it. But then you pull back, you look at the satellite imagery, and you can actually see where there was a waterway. And it starts to all make sense. And that gentle slope, that slope comes out to like 0.07% or something, which is like the perfect slope for waterways like the Nile or the Mississippi or any of those other ones. You could easily sail up and down it and all of those things. And a waterway can be blocked by a shawl of mud, which is another confusing statement that Plato tells us that we've never been able to figure out. He says, after the cataclysm, the way to Atlantis was blocked by a shawl of mud. Well, the open sea is not going to be blocked by a shawl of mud. Even if there's a big pile of mud, you sail around it in the open sea. So you have to have some waterway that's constrained to some degree. Well, the only place we have that in the 15 places that people, well, other than Antarctica, we have no idea what's under the ice, but it's too far away. The only place we have that is the Rishat structure. Plato tells us that they dug a canal 100 feet deep, 300 feet wide, and 50 stadia in length from the inner island that had the palace to the outer ring. And by the palace, he says there was a harbor. Okay. Well, 50 stadia, when you do that math, it comes out to like 5¾ miles. Well, how far is the center island from the outer ring on the Rishat structure? 5¾ miles. He says that they built bridges over those channels, and on the outer ring, the piece they cut into the bedrock was three stadia, which is 1,800 feet. Well, there's a three stadia cutout at the southern end of the Rishat structure. He says that the north of the city was sheltered and the south was open. Well, the north of the Rishat structure has mountains and the south is open. And it just goes on and on and on like that. People think it's a collapsed volcanic dome. Well, he tells us there was hot and cold springs on the center island. Well, you have to have a volcano. That's how you get hot and cold water. He tells us that they had tremendous agricultural prowess and that they could grow like all the plants of the earth or something like that. And then he goes on and he says that there were 60,000 10 by 10 stadia farms. 60,000, which is, I mean, that's a lot of farms. So 10 by 10, so a stadia, you do the math, and that's like a little bit like 1.1 miles. So it's like 60,000 1.1 mile squares have to go somewhere. Well, you start to look at Mauritania and the plain of West Africa where this thing sits. It's one of the only land masses on the planet that's flat enough to have that. Plus, and I've gotten very lucky, and this hasn't been released. I mentioned it, but I haven't shown the evidence to anyone yet. But I had a chemical geologist look at, I found what looked to me like very regimented canal earthworks on a massive scale that go under the sand. But there's all this weird black rock caked on the top, and it's all in grid patterns. And we're talking like over dozens and dozens and dozens of miles. So I had a geologist look at it, and they referred me to a chemical geologist. They told me that what those are probably are, they're probably called what they're called salt evaporites. What's a salt evaporite? So what a salt evaporite is if all salt is sodium chloride and it all comes from the sea. So if a tsunami wave came in, sat there for a long time, and then eventually evaporated, and then it got turned into a desert, it cooked for hundreds of years. And we see that. But the cool thing is they're hard as rock, but they've preserved all of the earthworks underneath the sand. And I know where this is. I haven't told anyone. David Stickhansen is the only other guy that knows where this is. And we're gonna release it. But you know, I mean, it's like I'm not just confident. It's if this wasn't it, then Plato it was Edgar Cayce, and he was able to look into the future. It's like it's impossible to have this many coincidences for this location.
So Mauritania is in Northwest Africa. It's in the Sahara Desert, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much.
We should. Can you give us a time frame? When did Plato say Atlantis was destroyed?
Yeah. The classic way to derive this date, which looks right to me because I did it all myself, is basically he says it happened in 600 BCE. That's what Plato tells us. And then in the story, the Egyptian priest tells Solon it happened 9,000 years before they were talking. So you add 600 to 9,000, you get 9,600, which is another one of these numbers, this magical. I mean, for Plato, in 400 BCE to have picked that date out of the air, because I mean, you know, we all know this date. We've all learned because we've all watched Graham Hancock and all that. Younger Dryas. We know to say younger Dryas. One of the things I had to do is like, well, what's a Dryas? I mean, I'm really trying to pull this thing apart. So I looked, and it turns out what a Dryas is a flowering plant that does really well in colder weather at higher elevations. And there's been three Dryas events. All the younger Dryas is the most recent one. It ended in 9600 BCE. Then there was the older Dryas and the oldest Dryas. Now, no one came to me for these names, very creative names. But they all range from like 9600 BCE, and then they go back about 10,000 years or so. And what these are times where the temperature on the Earth got really cold. So there are lots of these flowering plants. Then at the end of the younger Dryas, we know accepted science, as they say, that the temperature of the Earth increased 30 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit some really quickly. Maybe it was a year, maybe it was 6 months, maybe it was 2 days, but it was really quickly. It got hot. And then, of course, and people were like, well, even if the water is raising an inch, you know, a week, that's no one's going to be surprised by that. It's like, whoa, think about it. So you have all this ice on the ice caps, all that weight is shifting around. And we know the North Atlantic Ridge is the thinnest land mass, you know, it's the thinnest crust anywhere. So it doesn't have to shift much and you get a tsunami. And when you look at the aerial photography, you can still see it. You can still see it today. You can see the runoff of the water of West Africa. If anyone can do it, go to Google Earth, just zoom out far enough and kind of look from the east to the west over West Africa and you'll see it. So it all makes sense. And nothing I've said, by the way, is contentious at all. If we were to find a mainstream academic, they would agree with the data points. They might not agree with my conclusions, but no one's going to argue that the Sahara was green in 9600 BCE. We all know that it was.
Right. The other points, geographically related to Libya, Egypt, and Europe, well, it certainly ticks that box. What else do we need to see here? A center island surrounded by two concentric circles of land and water. So talk to me about how Atlantis is configured.
This Rishat thing is the only thing in the world that looks like that. It's perfect. It looks like Atlantis when you hear those words. There's a center island, and then there's two rings of land outside of it. It sits in a topology that when it rained a lot in 9600 BCE would have been a lake. And it's a big lake. I mean, it's like 10 miles from the edge to this island in the middle. And the island, if the radius is 5¾ miles, that means it's like 12 miles across, or I'm going to have that math works, 11 miles across. No, yeah, 12. I'm okay. 11½ miles across. So we have that. Here's what Plato says, by the way, about what after one of these deluges, what happens? He says, the earth has fallen away all around and sunk out of sight. The consequence is that in comparison of what was then, there are remaining only the bones of the wasted body, as they may be called, as in the case of small islands, all the richer and softer parts of the soil having fallen away and the mere skeleton of the land being left. And if that's not a description of what we see when we look at the Rishat, and anyone can go look this up, go to Google, type in R-I-C-H-A-T, hit on images, you have a wall of them and you can see it. And the first, as soon as I've shown this to everyone, every time they see it, like, oh yeah, that looks like it. We've got that. There's a few more measurements that we have. So Richard, have you ever heard of the Piri Reis map? I'm sure you have.
Yes, from Graham. Yeah. You mentioned Graham Hancock. From Graham Hancock.
I still have my first edition Fingerprints of the Gods 1995 book. I remember vividly. I bought it in an airport. I read it on the plane and my life was changed. I love the guy, especially his early work. I don't know what he's been doing the past 10 years. I listened to him, but I mean, the Piri Reis map, the big consternation about it, and what Graham Hancock says about it, is that the left-hand side and the bottom seem to show more detail about the land masses than could have been known. It was made in like 1512, or 1514. So it's like 20 or 22 years after Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492.
But it was a composite of really ancient maps, right?
That is the belief which seems to hold.
Yeah,
and all of this is arguable, and no one can win the argument. So if you look at the bottom and you see the continental shelf of Antarctica, which it seems to show perfectly. then you see that. If you look at the bottom and you decide that these that Piri Reis was an idiot and he commissioned a map, he didn't have a big enough piece of paper, so they had to bend the bottom of South America over, then that's what you see. One of my assumptions is we can't assume these folks are idiots. So the idea that it was drawn wrong because there wasn't enough paper, I can't accept that. Doesn't mean I carte blanche accept the other side. Anyway. No, on the left, on the right-hand side of the map, on the east side, is the coast of Africa that we're interested in. And we've all been looking at this. I stared at this for 50 years, and it never occurred to me. But if you bring up the map right now and you look at Africa, there's a big elephant, which Plato mentions elephants. There's some green mountains. He mentions green mountains. And then you look, and there's like some hills blocking a river. And then a little farther in, there's this kooky little city surrounded by a ring of water, up a river, and it is exactly where the Rishat structure is. And Piri Reis, he's getting on a boat. He's an adventurer. He's not going to accept a map into the middle of the Sahara Desert and saying there's a river there when it's clearly nothing but 140-degree desert. So it doesn't mean that that's how the land was when he was there, but it means the map it was taken from was a trusted map. And it's sitting right there. And I don't know what else we could look at. No one's drawing a city in a ring of water in the middle of Africa, exactly where the Rishat structure is, which is exactly where Plato tells us it is, unless someone thought it was there and saw it and drew the map. So the evidence just keeps piling up when you look at it, you know, with fresh eyes.
All right, we'll take another time out, come back and discuss Atlantis with David Edwards. Stay with us.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
And we are back with David Edward. His book, Atlantis Solved, The Final Definitive Proof. Now, I mean, this evidence is overwhelming. However, there is one that's kind of confusing, and that is Plato talks about or writes about the size of Atlantis. I think he said it's like the size of Libya plus Asia.
He says it's bigger than Libya and Asia combined.
Yeah,
well, Asia is pretty big. Plato, it's very, very big. Now, when Plato says Asia, he's talking mostly about what we would call Asia Minor or Turkey, because that's where the Persians were. And to prove that, I always point out, I mentioned Alexander the Great and Plato lived at the same time. 20 years after Plato's death, Alexander the Great is conquering the known world. He gets to India and he starts weeping because he thinks he's at the end of the continent. But India's only halfway. So I can back up what I say. So when you take Asia Minor and Libya wasn't like we see it today. It was pretty much the entire northern coast of Africa from Egypt to what we would call the Atlas Mountains of Morocco today, but didn't go in quite as deep. So because they didn't know, it was just too far. But the landmass is about the same. So if you go look at the square miles of Asia Minor and Libya and you add them together, you get about 1 million square miles. So that means that the continent that the capital city sits on has to be able to account for at least 1 million square miles of land. Another important thing, this word continent, that we've gotten hung up on that. I actually looked this up. I went to Encyclopedia Britannica and a few other places. There's no formal definition of a continent. It's a contrivance. It just basically means a big piece of land that we can see as its own region. That's like the formal definition. So when you take all that into account, and then you look at West Africa, and you look at Mauritania and up to over into Mali, which is this whole plain I'm talking about, up to Morocco, it's 2 million square mile. So it's absolutely bigger than what Plato would have considered Libya and Asia combined. And there's other things. He tells us that the Atlanteans were really good working with fusile metals. Well, what's a fusile metal? I watched Forged in Fire. I don't know if I know what, you know, I had to look it up. And it turns out a fusile metal is like bronze. It's a metal that you can melt and work with relatively easily, you know, not quite like iron or some of the harder.
This is before the Bronze Age we're talking about, right?
Well, this is way before the Bronze. Yeah. This is 6,000 years before. Yeah. We are hip deep in the Neolithic. Now I was, let me mention the, so one of Mauritania's biggest exports still today is precious metals. But you know, let's talk about the Neolithic in this time period, 9600. I mentioned the date was magical. In addition to those things I said about what's going on in the climate, culturally, we've got Göbekli Tepe, which dates to the same day. It's same day Plato talks about. I mean, not like the same year, the same day. And so we can look at that and we can say, okay, that's a level, of technology, you know, that we can start to apply, to the Atlanteans. Oh, I'm sorry, but there's other nice. We're also hip deep in what they call the pre-pottery Neolithic. So this is a lot of technology with rocks, but it's all rocks. They haven't figured out they can get dirt wet and cook it yet. And we're also in the middle of what they call the agricultural revolution. So this is, you know, we start to see agriculture show up. Well, the Atlanteans are really good at agriculture, and when you start to look at the isolation and size and resources they had, of course they are. Because they can start to, you know, that's what we know people were at this location in 9600 BC. They were what we would call cavemen. That's okay. But if I'm a caveman, I see this beautiful lake or beautiful island, I go over to it. Now no one can mess with me. The saber-toothed tigers aren't hunting me anymore. I can grow stuff. You know what I mean? It's a good place to live.
Right, right. What's happening in Saharan Africa 9600 years ago? What does it look like?
It looks like, so you're in Canada. So for me, I always describe it as looking like Georgia in the U.S. So it's kind of it's not quite our farm belt. It's southern, it's south of that, but it's not tropical. So just nice. And it rained, it probably rained every day, you know, and they were, and it's well known. For example, at this time period, Lake Chad, which is, which would have been the eastern boundary of this plain I'm talking about, it was the biggest freshwater lake on the planet because of all the rain. And there's been hundreds, if not thousands, but at least hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rivers and river basins and all that stuff mapped back to this time period. Very well established, Green Sahara, 9600 BCE, good place to live.
So after the cataclysm, of the Younger Dryas, what happened? I mean, did the Atlanteans scatter? Did they have, they must have had dealings with the Egyptians. The Egyptians wrote about them. I mean, do we lose the trail? What happened to the Atlanteans?
No.
Does anyone pick
it up? No, we don't lose the trail. So there's something called the Sicilian Channel Monolith, which is a sunken monolith. It sits down, I think it sits at 40 meters, but it's on a big hill. It's south of Sicily and north and west of Malta. It only could have been, it's a big monolith, it's underwater, and it only could have been put there when that land was above water. Well, that land was only above water during the last ice age or before. So we've got that, lots of that stuff, but we do have a trace of, and then we've got cultural things we can look at, but I'm not an anthropologist. But in Herodotus, in the histories, who wrote, so we have Solon, who's like 600 BCE, Herodotus is writing like 480 BCE, and Plato's writing like 360 BCE, but they all would have, you know, known each other going backwards, and there would have been a little bit of cultural overlap. But he actually mentions the Atlanteans. It never comes up. I don't know why it's not like on a billboard somewhere. He tells us, he says, and so what Herodotus is the first person who really tried to be a historian in the Western tradition. Mm-hmm. So he sat down, he said, you know what, I'm going to write down what's going on, but it's not Greek propaganda. He's trying to be, you know, neutral and just tell the story. Now he's a Greek, so he's going to have that worldview. But the first third of the book, he just kind of does a travelogue. He says, here's everything we know about the world. Here's everyone in it. And here's where everything is. And then after that, he starts to talk about the Persian Wars and, you know, give us the histories. But pretty early on in that, he says, he talks all about Egypt and everything. And then from Egypt, he says, you travel west for 10 days and there's not much. And you travel 10 more days and you start to run into these people who call themselves the Atlanteans. And they stretch all the way on the coast from a little bit west of Egypt all the way to the Atlas Mountains. And he says they're really weird people. He says they live on top of salt piles in these weird houses they built. They spend their days cursing the sun. They don't dream. They won't eat meat. And they not only do they not have a writing system, they will prevent you from writing their names down. So he like couldn't report any of the names because whoever went there to look at them, they couldn't write it down. And they're called Atlanteans. And if you look at this plane I've been talking about and the culture in the Mediterranean pulling you that way and the idea of a tsunami coming in from the West, this is where you end up. It's where you go. And of course, not every Atlantean was home when the tsunami hit, right? We're talking about, we believe it's a trade culture. So there would have been, in anywhere we can find is one of those provinces, there would have been Atlanteans there. So the capital gets wiped out, but we can find the traces of them. And so between that and the story, and what's interesting is these people called the Atlanteans geographically end up really close to that West Nile Delta where the cult of Neith showed up, and then where we start to get the Atlantean story from. So again, I'm a physical guy. You can look at the physical world. You can see how the story moved, and we can find these pieces talking about, you know, the remnants of the society.
Any theories as to why these weird Atlanteans, in Herodotus' own words, curse the sun?
I do. So I have resisted picking a reason for the end of the Younger Dryas. I don't have any idea what it could be. It could have been an earthquake. You know, many people like comets or meteors or, you know, something that caused the Earth, because, you know, the Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees. When did that happen? You know, that kind of stuff. But I've resisted all of that. It's clear there was a tsunami. I don't know what caused it. Was that your question?
It was about why they cursed the sun.
The curse. So many of those escalate. Let's say an asteroid hit the Earth and tilted it, and, you know, the Earth kind of shifted to the west and all the water came back. Well, if you're sitting on the planet and you're looking up, the sky is doing all kinds of crazy things, and the sun would move all around. So my theory is that it is a cultural memory, because, you know, these are primitive people, not stupid people by any means, but they are primitive people. And if the day that it all blew up was the day the sun was going all over the place, then culturally they curse the sun. They blame the sun.
It all fits so wonderfully.
Well, it does. And I'm calling this the Grand Unified Theory of Atlantis. And I'm talking to brilliant people like you, because I'm trying to get the word out, because it's completely solvable. If we can push away all the death rays and the nuclear submarines and everything we've heard and our own biases and just look at it, it's right there. And so basically what it means, and I think it's important, is we can establish a location and a time mile marker where there was a seafaring, not British sea vessels with cannons, but they were able to navigate the oceans. And we I forget the guy's name, but the boat Ra 2, 1970, he made the reef boat and sailed all over the place.
Oh, the Kon-Tiki?
Yeah. I'm getting ready to start. I haven't started researching that, but I'm aware of it. But it basically just said, yeah, what we see on Lake Titicaca, those reed boats, yeah, they could get anywhere pretty easily, you know. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. And then, so there's the answer. So there was a society, something bad happened. They weren't magicians. It seemed, when you look at them, they had an exotic culture. They were very good at agriculture. It seems like they were more in tune with the earth side of things, which a lot of us like. They don't seem to have had computer. It wasn't that kind of advance, you know?
No.
And there they were. And when you do that and you pick and you lock in that date, all the pyramids make sense. Peru makes sense. Everything makes sense. And it all fits. And for some reason, when I say this, I have some people that will scream. And I had one guy call me, yelled at me for like 10 minutes. I don't know what it is. I don't know if I'm up against like a conspiracy. I don't think I am. I don't know what it is. People resistant to the obviousness of this.
Right. Well, I guess Atlantis has its fanboys, and that culture includes, you know, the nuclear submarines and the free energy and flying cars, and you're bursting their bubble, I guess.
Well, it's that side. It's not just that side. The academic side is vehemently out. Anyone, in fact, I mentioned the dean of philosophy at Yale. As soon as the administration discovered that I had said the word Atlantis in my life, they jumped in and they cut off contact. And I had a meeting scheduled. They canceled the administration, not the lady. The administration canceled the meeting. She won't return my emails. And that happened with her. That was Yale University. Wow. I had a physical anthropologist lined up from King's College in London. Same thing. The chemical geologist that I mentioned answered all my questions, was telling me all kinds of stuff that was just fantastic. And then I asked, well, do you think this could be like ancient, you know, Neolithic farming, which I guess clued them in, and then boom, gone out, you know? So it's like, I don't know why, but I feel like everyone needs to know this. I think it's important. It aligns our entire past and it tells us a lot about the planet, and it gives us a fresh lens to look at all of that, the ancient history we have that we've ignored. So.
Amazing.
But
all right.
Yeah.
How do we get a copy of Atlantis Solved?
The publisher website is frequency99.com. The nines are numbers, frequency99.com. If you go there, there's paths to everywhere.
All right. And the YouTube channel again?
A History Of. And the way YouTube works, I feel like an old guy explaining email to people, because maybe everyone knows this, but you go to youtube.com/ and you do the @ sign, like an email sign, and you just do a history of all lowercase, and it takes it to the channel.
Fantastic. Well, case closed.
Case closed. Yeah.
All right. Next, do Bigfoot.
Actually, I'm doing the procession of the stars to see if the processions relate to cataclysms and if there's a cycle to this whole thing. I'm gonna dig into that for real and solve it.
Oh, wow. Can't wait for that. David, what a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for this.
All right, Richard, I feel like I know you. I've listened to you for so many years. I'm a huge fan, so thank you for talking to me.
Oh, well, now I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm glad we met. Thank you so much.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.